You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by Food Matters Live.
Welcome to the Table Talk podcast. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a writer and broadcaster specialising in food and science. Now, in this episode, we're looking outside the box, or rather, looking at the box itself, or looking in. What I mean is, we're exploring the connection between brands and creative pack design. What's the message that it conveys? How do designers do their work to make it special, to stand out? And crucially, how do they make it viable for the consumer? What's the future of food packaging, and what are the issues and concepts that will influence that? Now, we've got an absolutely stellar panel to discuss packaging design, and I'm going to ask them to introduce themselves and also to tell us their favourite example of packaging, whether that's something wonderful or just wonderfully awful. Deborah, let's start with you.
Good afternoon. I'm Deborah Dawson. I'm Chief Executive of the Design Business Association, and we represent some 400 design agencies and brands across the UK, covering all sorts of design disciplines, so from packaging to branding to industrial design. And our job really is to champion the professionalism of the sector and the sector itself. My favourite piece of packaging, I think, is an old one. It has to be the original box that the iPhone came in. And it was that thing where you could just take that cellophane wrapper off and lift the lid, and it was almost a Star Wars type thing, wasn't it? Where it was like a pshhh, oh, and the lid came off.
I'm getting a bit excited with you just saying that.
That's design and brand and all of those things working perfectly together. That's
a good example. Okay, we also have two Chris's. We're going to start off with Chris Orkett.
Hi, I'm Chris Orkett, director at The Big Picture. The Big Picture are an insight agency specialising in the world of design and innovation. So that covers all things from early stage kind of consumer understanding, ethnography, lots of work in tribes and defining tribes for brands, all the way through to evaluating great design and packaging, both through qualitative and quantitative methods. We are sort of the middle of the Venn diagram between consumers and design, in whatever form that takes. In terms of favourite piece of packaging, it's a piece of packaging that age 30 took me back to feeling like a 10-year-old. And again, like Deborah's example, a kind of structural packaging example that just created like a child at Christmas moment. It was at Christmas, but I was 30. Skullcandy headphones that I received a couple of years back. And just the whole opening experience felt so considered, so delightful, sort of felt like a journey. So I unwrapped them and then went through this process of sort of opening this book of a box that told me a bit about the brand story, and then these headphones in a leather case. And everything about it just sort of kind of allowed the gift to sort of punch above its weight. And I think great design does that. It allows brands to sort of get an emotional connection with someone and punch above their weight.
Okay, and Chris number two, Chris Griffin.
Hi, my name's Chris Griffin, Chief Executive of the Museum of Brands in Notting Hill, which hopefully you've heard of, and hopefully will visit. It's a wonderful collection going back 200 years of brands, packaging and advertising, representing brands, technology, a terrific place, great venue. Also co-founder of PI Global, which is a global brand agency with New York, London and Mumbai. Starting off with structural packaging design way back, and also branding design now. I really feel that it's hard to put forward a pack, my favourite pack, because all the experiences that my colleagues have raised have got so many sort of other issues around them. So, I cannot now see a pack without seeing the total system that this country is either getting right or not. So I'm going for something that is an awful pack today, but within a great system, and that's called Gusto, which is a home delivery food, fabulous food, tailored, wonderful recipes. And each ingredient is designed just for that meal. So there's quite a lot of packaging, and the system isn't closed yet to take it back, but when it is, then we've got a great system, we've got very little food waste, And I think it's an indicator of the future. So I'm very excited about what they would do next. I'm not pitching for the job.
But it's if it comes your way.
I wouldn't refuse it. Complain. Yeah. But it's there to be done. Quickly.
Well, my example of great packaging, of my favourite packaging, is the cover of the Operation game. Because my sister's on it. And there was a commercial where she said, "I'll have his funny bone," which I think was dubbed by somebody else saying it. But, yeah. There you go, which is that's quite a partisan way of looking at it. Right, let's get into the meat of all this. First of all, I'd like to ask, what do we mean by packaging design? Imagine I'm an alien from planet Anti-Package. I don't know what we're talking about. What is packaging design, and what are the tools at the packaging designer's disposal? Deborah, could you start with us?
I suppose, I mean, for packaging design for me would be anything that comes in something or anything that needs to be delivered to someone by some means. Chris has probably got a better description of it, having researched most of it, I suppose. But it covers, yeah, anything that isn't, I suppose, naked and raw, if I can put it that way, like fruit and veg might be. And what was your second question?
No, that'll do. I mean, that's quite a complex one, just to start off with that, really. But what, knowing that, what are the tools at the packaging designer's disposal, I guess? What do they use to create this?
Yeah, so I think that's changed over time. I think there was a day when it was very tactical. It was one of knowing materials, packaging goods, either to sell them or to get them to somewhere. Whereas today, I think the tools of the packaging designer are far broader than that. It's a strategic piece of work that needs to be done, certainly within the context of everything else that's happening in a business. And so there's a breadth and depth of knowledge and understanding, I think, that packaging designers need today that goes well beyond where they were 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah. So, Chris Walker, if you can give us some examples of what we're talking about. So the simplest thing might be a bag. What's the most spectacular or involved type of packaging that you might be asked to do, and just give us some examples of the breadth of this.
Goodness me. Well, I guess in its essence, we're thinking about packaging as its functional role. It is its role is to deliver something protected to an end user that couldn't otherwise be delivered. We look at all of the current uproar and right uproar with the supermarkets in terms of unnecessary plastic around things that could well be delivered.
Go on, give us an example of one of your pet hates.
Well, you just look at the fruit and veg aisle, and I know some things require food waste is incredibly incredibly large contributor to the sustainability issue, but the amount of plastic packaging that is unnecessarily on show there. You look at things like what Morrisons have done in terms of rolling back that sort of strategy, Waitrose bulk approach, which they're trialling in Oxford, which is very interesting. But yes, if we go
ruinous for packaging designers, isn't it?
Oh, right, I know. It's, well, I guess the point is that design and packaging should add value where necessary.
Right, should be appropriate.
Exactly, and you have both functional and emotional positives and benefits to packaging. Great functional packaging does the job with the least amount of friction, with the least amount of kind of, it is tailored for the user. And then there's the added value that packaging can bring. So there are the emotional ergonomics that you can build into design that, I talked earlier about just that added value. And I
think examples?
I've got my reusable coffee mug here, and it's little things like the thought and consideration they've shown sort of to have a little click top at the lid that just locks it in place, so you don't have the lid hitting you on the nose as you go and sip your coffee each time. But there are quality cues that come from design that don't have to be superfluous and adding waste to the process, or don't have to be excess, but they are just adding value. So that would be one example. I think at the end of the day, we're in an incredibly fascinating time. Deborah mentioned materials. Almost materials and innovation in packaging are probably going to come to the fore almost more now than they have over the last 5-10 years, maybe, because all of a sudden it's, is this material the right material? And there's a real push for the amount of waste that we're creating. And how do we limit that?
Before we get on to concepts like sustainability, Chris Griffin, can we talk about the connection between the brand itself and the packaging? Is this a is this vital? Does it always work for people? What does packaging design equal brand?
Yes, I think it does, and because it's very simple. Test we do with consumers or in research is to change some elements and see which key elements of the design still work with consumer, and the consumer doesn't notice that you've changed the name of Kellogg's to Coggles or something else because they're reading all the other cues, and the shape goes in quite subliminally as well, very powerful. So that's all still working out there. And the category cues, I think there's quite a few. People are trying to deliver milk to the market that isn't milk, has nothing to do with animals, for instance, and they're using cow cues to get it there. You know, fascinating stuff. Mm-hmm. How's that going to work? Sadly, they're also missing the brand point. But anyway, we'll come to
that. I mean, from your point of view, are there as many examples of bad connections between packaging design and brand as there are good ones?
Well, I'm concerned about going around, say, Food Matters line and seeing all of the new brands coming to market that are missing some of the fairly basics. But of course, a lot of these brands now are coming through different channels, so it's not about stand out on shelf. And so, you know, brands like Grays that are coming through your letterbox and Gusto through the postal delivery. So now a pack design has to really consider the different channels it's going to go through, and it's not all about sitting on a supermarket shelf.
And can you give us some specific examples of brand packaging that you think works particularly well to reinforce or to promote?
Well, I mean, I suppose if you look around the museum, there are some brands where the consumer is looking at a Kellogg's cornflakes packet from the 1950s and saying, that hasn't changed a bit, until you show them today's pack and they say, oh yeah, it's quite different, isn't it? And what the designers have done over that period of time is kept the brand relevant, modern, but they've got the core elements that are still working for the consumer. And that's got to be a good brand, because you've got, you know, decades of performance on shelf. That's massive equity. Yeah.
I think another great example for me would be Freddie's Flowers. And there's something that doesn't come via the retailers. It obviously comes straight to your home. I think it's those things that shift the needle for other brands, where you've got someone coming into a market looking at the needs of the consumer in a completely different way, and then finding that route literally onto people's doorsteps, who understands the product that they're selling, and that when they're cut younger and fresher, they're also smaller. And you can package this stuff in a completely different way.
Do you think this is a big area of potential for packaging, that the reuse should be central to it?
Yeah, I mean, I think you've got to look at infrastructures, but I think in the Western world, certainly there is a massive opportunity there. And it's a really exciting, I think it should be seen as an exciting opportunity for packaging designers and from a packaging perspective. You look at the trials of Loop and this kind of cross-brand sign-up milkman service for your groceries, and the delight you could create from more designed but reusable packaging that stays within a continuous loop and stays within that circular loop, and then there's a refill model going on. It's really exciting, and you think about the role of design in home, the role that design can play over repeated use. You talk about bad packaging. I mean, there's some laundry tubs and things like that where it's like a wrestle every time you're trying to get into it. And you talk about brand equity, and in fact, in that case, the erosion of brand equity, because yeah, you're paying £6 for some laundry things, and you, every time you're trying to get in there, you're wrestling it open, and your fingers are burning with pain. And so the thought of reuse actually adding value at that kind of second moment of truth, so that in home and you're repeatedly using it, that, you know, you could, I'm not talking about pyrotechnics and dry ice, but, you know, some delightful design that doesn't have to harm the planet or create massive supply chains. Mm.
And this concept of sustainability, Deborah, is that a relatively recent idea, or is it always at the heart of these things because of cost?
I don't think it's at the heart of things because of cost, because usually it costs more. And so it's been something that's been pushed to one side. I think it's been something that brands have aspired to be able to react to, but the fact of the matter is, until a lot of things change, it's going to cost them more to do that. I think the challenges, I mean, sustainability, there are all sorts of things, areas of this that you can look at. You do your brand a disservice, I think, if you look at just a pack, if you commission a pack. It's a bit like going to the dentist and saying, just give me a filling before you've had the checkup. The reason Freddie's Flowers works and the reason other brands are working is that they ask a much bigger question first, which isn't, can you fix the thing I've got? It's actually, is the way I'm delivering what I do still the right way to deliver? And so what you do is you pull it back to, and that's what designers are great at, is your brand will never innovate if you just keep asking for the next pack. The trick is to pull it back one step and say, what's happening in the world? Where are our consumers? An example I would give is Pears soap. I've got one of those Pears soap dispensers, which is a Pears soap shape. Try and say that after that. And I love it. But my husband and I have had a bit of a fight about whether I'm allowed to buy another one or not. And the answer's no, because of the packaging waste. And so I'm scouring everywhere to find out if I can get 5 litres of the stuff in some container that allows me to refill this. And the fact of the matter is, I should be able to do that. I should be able to get 5 litres of this stuff because I have got space to store that, and I can just refill this carton. So I think brands are going to have to start to look at what it is that their consumers are trying to do if they want to keep those consumers.
So it's no good just being whizzy. It's got to be appropriate. It's got to be true to what the brand needs and what the brand's trying to say.
It's a period of transition we're going through, and the government is so far behind on this one. It's quite disturbing in terms of helping deliver the systems. So what you might throw away in Leeds isn't appropriate in Swindon or London. So you have to know your own local recycling system, which is just crazy. So we've got 408 systems in the UK, all using different language, all classifying different packs and different materials. And the consumer really hasn't got a clue. I tested it in Ealing. Consumers just do not know what goes in recycling.
And you think this would sort of be birthing pains, but it's not. This stuff's been around for a long time.
We've been working on sustainable projects for 35 years, but it's the system that isn't being addressed. So the number of disposal council systems is just extraordinary.
It could be, though, couldn't it, Chris? Because I remember phoning First Mile up, and because I was getting really upset with the amount of stuff people were chucking in the bin at the office. And you can put everything in that bag and they pick it up on a Friday night, bar food waste. So where the material has become ruined by food, so pizza box, for example. But, even there we got some pizzas from Pizza Express recently and they had an extra piece of cardboard in the bottom, and I'm convinced it was there because it meant that the rest of the pack could actually go in the bin. Yeah. If it's not, then I'm reading more into it than I should be, but that's what it felt like to me. But what's frustrating is that at work I can chuck everything in one bag and at home I can't. Yeah. And I think that comes back to Chris's point that all of those systems, actually there is a solution. It's just that we need government to push.
Yeah. And it's facilitating that. Yeah. Facilitating that behaviour change as much as possible and not creating too much behaviour change for the consumer themselves. We've just done a think piece on sustainability and the appetite is there, it truly is, but that there's that say-do gap in, people say they want to do one thing, the reality is the pressures of life and, it's not to beat up on anyone, everyone has them, no one's as angelic as they might say. It's about facilitating as little consumer behaviour change as possible, just a clarity and a consistency. I know Ecova are really campaigning and working hard to just try and get sort of the type of plastic used in packaging to be almost more consistent. And, even that is just, we're still talking about plastic. So,
Chris Griffin, you're sighing about this. What's your thought?
Just extreme frustration with the whole process, because I think that the moment it's being driven more by media. And so we've got rid of plastic bags. Waitrose exercise over in Oxford, we've taken the most vulnerable products, right, and taken the packaging off. We have an exhibit at the museum, which is 2 cucumbers, one wrapped, one not, and we just let them sit there over time. One is soggy quite quickly, it's just deteriorating. And the one in the plastic wrap, if you take
anaerobic bacteria,
yeah. And if you take the resource that's gone into producing a cucumber relative to the plastic that's used to wrap it in that instance, and it's not across the board, you know, really what each brand wants to do is a life cycle analysis with a decent recovery system, then we start to get closer to a solution that could work for the country. But I'm a long way off that.
So when you're at dinner parties and you say, yeah, I do packaging design, when you go out of the house, maybe you don't go out of the house, do people tend to say, oh, you're the person putting my tomatoes in three wraps? And what's the reality of this?
I mean, we've made great strides with resealable bacon packs and stuff, you know, so I think designers have gone a long way to make it better. But ultimately, this isn't going to be solved by packaging designers. It's going to be solved by system people like government and the like.
I think it's very hard, isn't it, for consumers on one hand to say they want their tomatoes to arrive like they were plucked out of the field an hour ago, and yet they're not prepared to buy 5 kilos of rice. And I can't remember what the fact was, but there was a hideous fact in the paper 2 weeks ago about the number of single-use plastic pouches that are now being bought for all of your kind of your wheat-based products, your rices, your pulses that can be microwaved in 2 minutes. You can't have your cake and eat it.
My wife buys those.
Does she?
Yes.
And do you eat them?
No.
No, of course not.
We haggle a bit. Yeah. We haggle a bit. You know, obviously, we keep the peace at the same time.
There's a price to be paid, and there's something to be said for those old systems of, buying produce more locally to where you live. I think the nature of the high street needs to change in order for that to become possible for people. To know where things come from, to buy things differently. And it goes, it's far beyond trying to get retailers to change what they do. This is about changing the consumer and how the consumer consumes.
Yeah. And we have an addiction to convenience that has developed, I think, as a consumer. And that's a very hard addiction to get over. And it needs legislative kind of support to do that. And almost, whether syntax, there's evidence supporting the fact that syntax is like your plastic bag tax or cost. Some of them do work depending on where they're applied, but it is that inconvenient addiction to plastic or to convenience or to that, it's that present focus bias essentially.
Shouldn't all of these things be a gift to designers to be able to say, well, here's a concept that people care about. There we go. There's a draw. You can incorporate this into your design and become better. The brand will be better. But is that happening in practice, do you think?
No, and I don't think the commercial imperative is probably there enough.
People say they care, but they really...
Of course, and it's, you know, there's a marketing trade-off as to what's going to create buzz versus is this actually, you know, it may not be sexy enough to put on the news that you've affected your supply chain to minimise food waste. Yeah. Whereas an ocean plastic campaign bottle might be seen as, oh, wow.
Bit sexy.
Loads of buzz, yeah. So yeah, it's very complex. These people are in limited companies, or, you know, they have shareholders, but... I think there does have to be this shift. It's how everyone gets together and sort of works together rather than kind of working in silos.
Yeah. Okay, let's shift the subject a little bit to the concept of multi-sensory perception. I'm interested in the idea that packaging says something about the product within, and that maybe... are there examples of packaging that uses... the feel of the material to emphasise something about the product inside, Deborah. All these different tools, so the sound of a crisp packet crunching and things like that. Is that something that's used commonly by designers?
I don't know. You're going to have to refer this one to the designers. Yeah. The first thing that went through my head was an avocado. Things that are naturally wrapped.
The banana. Talking,
all of those things. The two Chris's.
Okay, Chris's. Put it up to you. Examples of multisensory perception used in packaging design.
Yeah, certainly. So in a lot of our kind of global insight work, we've done some really interesting stuff into the five senses, or the kind of five senses, and the way they can enhance brand perceptions, the way they can help deliver messages for a brand.
And you have some examples.
Yeah, so we did a global whiskey study on premium whiskey and the impact that either secondary packaging, kind of luxury whiskey, and the impact that secondary packaging or opening mechanisms and things can build on the sensory experience. So the sort of deep thud of a cork sort of popping open, or the texture to label design. There are numerous ways. PG Tips green tea is currently in a cardboard box with a ingeniously designed little sort of lip kind of thing that when you open and close it has this sort of catch mechanism. Now, it's not an elaborate thing, but what it does is as you flick that open, you get this sense of freshness from a pop sensation, and there's almost a play factor to it.
I mean, is the sound of packaging important? Is that factored into packaging design?
It can be. I mean, it's easy at the luxury end, then you got much more flexibility. The key is doing it down at the other end where you're scraping, you know, for pennies. And so we did a design business, did a pack for Nestle in the States, a coffee pack, and it was all about the sound and the smell. So as you open it, you had to get the air moving so that you got the smell coming out, the aroma. Yeah. Of that first
one. So suddenly you've got to deal in fluid dynamics and all sorts of other
all sorts of disciplines. Stuff, yeah. And the golden syrup thing we did, and not to make rude noises as you're dispensing it, which kids probably love, but but we trialled the valve to stop the inappropriate noises.
Yeah. Well, I'd say it's a sales pitch in many ways. Yeah. In my house. Wow. That's a whole different bag. Now, are there regulatory issues involved with packaging design that we as the consumer don't really sort of think about?
We're an insight agency, so we don't deal with the regulations too much. We deal with inspiration, not regulations.
You're
so much,
in dreams rather than rules.
Oh, absolutely, yeah, it's way more fun.
I think it's a good point. Well, I mean, there have been over time. I mean, one of the trends you might remember in the 80s was that you'd have the product. Tiny sort of product, and then an outer pack, and then another outer pack, and so you were fighting your way through layers. And then I think it was the Germans introduced a sort of an 80-20 rule on how much product you could have for the size of the pack. So it was like the headspace, you know, massive headspace. It was a cheat, really. And so, yeah, you just wouldn't do it now anyway. I think the other one, there will be more legislation, obviously. Cigarettes are kind of legislated against. There's pressure on other products, which must be resisted. And there has to be something with our ageing population on type. But I'm not sure.
I think the danger is you use legislation, I think, when you need to force the market to change. And I think consumer brands and designers need to be more clever than that and get to these issues and solve them before... that sort of thing's needed, so that you don't end up in a society where you're so restricted by what you can do. Actually, the fun has gone from it altogether. Mm-hmm. So, I think there are some really practical things. I think the aging one is a really interesting one, because if you look at the quantity or the proportion of the population that will be over 50, and you know, three of us around this room are wearing glasses, the other two probably have them hiding in their pockets somewhere, then it's a real problem. And, you know, if you're running around a supermarket trying to pick things up, or you're buying a piece of technology, I mean, you know, some of the type on some of these things is tiny. Mm-hmm. And it's not just about people with poor eyesight, that is seen as a disability, but just the way that you'd communicate to older consumers who maybe haven't grown up with the things that we're used to. So, yes, you want to avoid legislation as far as possible, because that brings the world of rules crashing in around you. But designers have to, and I think it's the responsibility of the brands they work for to determine how far they want to push things.
Yeah, we've been doing a fair bit in child resistant, senior friendly, and that trade off in a number of realms, whether it be pain relief, smoking cessation, all sorts of FMCG brands. There's a real challenge there in that you've got to make it reasonably difficult to get into, but not so difficult to get into. And that's a real designer's challenge, and maybe a kind of lick your lips and get stuck in as a structural designer, because it's a great brief, and it's how do you design packaging that is implicitly understood or at least intuitive, but not so intuitive that our lizard brain, our system, a kid can get into it, because it's that easy that you can learn it like they can learn the swipe of an iPad.
And is there a flip side to this? Has anyone here either been asked to or known of somebody who's been asked to do something for a brand that feels a bit like a con? Like, I mean, I know so many jars that it's impossible to get all of the product out of, and pots and things. And you don't need to name the brand, but anything that you've heard of that is a bit... things that feel a little cheeky.
Oh, I think the horror briefs that we have had over the years, because this is the design business talking, not the museum, of course, from the retailers saying, this is the lineup of our competition out there. Can you design our own label brand to be as close to the market leader as you can get?
And there have been some famous ones in the last couple of years.
There's been court cases and all. There's a whole body of work behind it.
And that's quite a common request, is it?
It was. We don't take on any retailers as a design business.
Yeah,
don't work for any.
And Chris,
because they don't understand brands. I mean, that was the core point.
Yeah. And any sort of cheeky asks, like, can you make this look bigger than it really is? I mean, is that core to what people are doing anyway?
I don't think so. I think our business is essentially making design work for consumers. And
I'm not accusing you of anything. I'm just saying, have you got any examples?
No, Your Honour.
Something you may have done. You're fully upstanding.
Not that I can think of from our experience. There is, of course, I guess, value perception that all brands are looking to kind of convey or sort of deliver. So it's you know, our product is a mainstream product. We want to look luxurious or things like that, and give a good, clear design brief as to, we want to be seen as the most luxurious mainstream, whatever product they are. But I can't really think of too many examples where it's kind of
I don't think it happens as much now, because the consumer's so much more educated. And I think most consumers do understand that quality is going to cost more. If you really want to have an impact on things environmentally, you've got to buy better quality products that last longer. The frustration for me is that you buy stuff that hasn't been designed to last as long as it could. And so Pears soap, I still want that 5-litre refill, because those things haven't been designed to be thrown away. So you go either one way or the other. Yeah. You're either doing those things because they are to be got rid of, or you're designing a thing in such a way that it can be refilled, for example.
But to answer you, I mean, it's a great question.
Yeah.
But actually, if you go around a supermarket, you'll find very few products that are actually designed to use the least amount of material. So take a packet of Shreddies or something. It's a large, thin rectangle.
Mm.
The smallest amount of material to pack that would be a sphere, which is not practical, but a cube would be next.
Yeah.
But it's got no shelf standout, you can't get the logo, it would compete, it would... But actually...
But the cube would have to be smaller than the volume of the rectangle, if we're going to get really technical about it. So it's interesting, because cereals came to mind for me until someone told me when they're packing them, they fluff up so much. That's why you end up with those 2 inches at the top that have nothing in. So I think sometimes there's the wrong thing happens. The very means by which they manufacture the stuff and fill it means it arrives on the consumer's table and the top 2 inches are empty. Mm. And we want to know where the rest of our Shreddies went.
No, but that's fine. Yeah. But if you take the weight of material in a box of cereal, not Shreddies, obviously they're fine.
Go on, have a go.
Any packet of cereal, because everyone is the same. It's a market norm that you have the biggest facing to get the biggest shout.
And you're using more packaging.
I'm
interested in that thing of taking the packaging and making it into something that could be a loudspeaker or a mask or a TV. Does anyone ever actually do it at home, and does it matter?
Yes.
It happens, but against the volume of the market, you've got to say no.
What do you mean by that?
Well, we did a Pringles lunch pack for kids. So it took, you know, big Pringles pack, and it takes so many, just at sort of lunchtime, 10 or something, whatever appropriate. And they were selling these things empty as well. And so it was a great craze.
Yeah.
Would you do that today, this market? No, it wouldn't just feel right. You're selling empty plastic to carry crisps around in.
So you run the Museum of Brands. What would you pay for? What are the classics that are out there that, you'd pay good money to have in the collection?
Oh, in the collection?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I mean, we're still after a wartime OXO pack. So there's a few objects that we are actually still searching for around the world, and we probably never will find. There's millions of stuff. I'm the wrong person to
too
ask.
Much stuff I want.
You know, we've got, say, 16,000 items on display, thousands and thousands more not. To name a favourite in there is just almost impossible.
Yeah. Okay, now let's talk about the designer themselves. Now, are designers of packaging constantly in conflict with the client? Are they, you know, are they constantly trying to say, no, you really want to do this, mate? And the client is saying, we want you to make this. Is there a battle between dreams and reality, or
depends on the client?
And who's got the dreams and who's got the reality?
Yeah, I think it depends on the client. I certainly think that there is a spectrum, but you will find designers have incredible desire to make an impact with design. That's why they're in the business. And brave clients write brave briefs where they know what they want. They are clear on the brand, what the brand stands for individually and independently, and they'll stand by that brief, even if the results scare them, and even if the designer comes out with something that is potentially challenging. If you design the right research, then you can support that sort of design case by showing, look, your users are going to find your brand, or look, this excites new users to check out something new from your new piece of innovation. But more often than not, there is I don't want to be the guy that reduced the logo size by 10% and we lost 10% sales and knocked 2 million off the brand value. So I think it requires bravery. I think there is, yes, no doubt, Chris will probably attest to, challenges and conflict between designer and client. I think the best relationships tend to be those where there is respect and collaboration and sort of a bit of trust in there, that it's not, look, we're all working towards a goal. We're not, as a design agency, in it just to win an award and then drop you after a year. Or the client knows that I've briefed you well. I have confidence in this is, as a brand, who we want to be, how we set ourselves apart. And if it means not following a cookie cutter 5% different to the last design, then okay. And we're respecting our equities and we're respecting how people recognise us and we're retaining that. Then, yeah, great. I don't know, how do you find it as a PI?
Well, I think, you know, amongst Deborah's membership, there's probably all sorts.
Yeah.
Some that would pursue what you might say is slightly unethical stuff because it's upmarket and it's premium and, you know, they've got the license and they're following, doing their own thing, and they can be fairly precious about it. And then at the other end, they're caught by all the restrictions that people are having to operate, the manufacturers are having to operate with. And so really, I think the fight for the designer now would be with the system and the materials and other things. And the manufacturers would like to better solutions as well.
I think the relationship works best when they understand that their jobs are different. And the piece I think that designers underestimate is the amount of time it took anything to arrive at their door. So the context within the business has got to be right for things to be able to happen. And those brand managers or design leaders within organisations are responsible for that. You don't just drop a piece of innovation in on a company and kind of hope it's going to sail through. Where the designers, I think, come into their own is being given the freedom to exercise the full breadth of their creative genius on a brand because the context has been created within which they can flourish. And the two jobs are very different. And when one steps into one territory, things go wrong. And when the other steps into the other's territory, it goes wrong. And to assume that you know how these things work because you've worked with one brand or 20 brands, I've never met two businesses that operate in the same way. So I think there has to be that respect. And for me, the context piece comes first because it's what enables things to move within business or not.
You don't want to become TV presenters. It's much simpler, my life, than yours.
Okay, then.
A lot of our listeners are food industry. What are the top tips to give to them in terms of how to go about working with a designer? Is it all about the brief? Is it about being true to your brand? How do you best communicate with your clients?
I'd go back to the dentist thing.
Yeah.
If there was one thing people took away from this, it's kind of don't walk into the dentist asking for the filling before the checkup. And it's give designers the opportunity to look at brands in the round and look at how they can exercise all of their skill on the business that's sitting in front of them. And sometimes that requires us to ask uncomfortable questions of the brands that we're working with. But you'll end up in a far better place further down the road. Clearly, there are instances when it is just a redesign or it's a tweak or something like that. And so the point I would make to designers listening to this then is, you know, don't annoy people by coming back with, you know, the brand innovation piece when all they wanted was kind of a 5% tweak on something. So it's horses for courses. But
do you get that a lot? Do designers kind of say, do you know what, if they just made this a bit fizzier or a different colour, then we could have a great campaign?
Yeah.
Does that happen quite
but
a bit?
Yes, and I think, again, it's the respect. With respect, you've got to believe that those people that are working in business who commission this stuff have got an idea of what it is their businesses need and the direction their businesses are going in. Not always, unfortunately. But, and there are times when it is appropriate to challenge, but there are also times when it's not. You know, there are times when you do not die in a ditch over certain things.
Yeah.
And so I think the best designers know when to push and when not to push. The best brand leaders know when to go in for the big ask and when not to.
Mm. Just for a bit of fun then, does anyone have an example of a grand scale cock up that's been done in design where somebody changed something and it was a disaster? It doesn't have to be one of yours, don't worry.
I think the first one I saw when I joined the industry decades ago, it was a wonderful, these technical guys had developed a pouch that could hold carbonated, keep beer fresh. And they'd used a lamination of product. It's brilliant. I mean, so, you know, this sachet could sit on the shelf for quite a while and keep the beer nice and fresh. So, and it's long and thin, this sachet. And so you open a sachet of carbonated beer. And what happens? It's extraordinary. We got it in the museum.
I
still look at it and think, how did anyone get so far in this development without saying, so how do you hold it?
Yeah. There's fascinating examples of kind of ridiculously unergonomic design. But I think sometimes it's not bad design because we're thinking about cross borders. But when you think about semiotics and codes of different things in different markets, you can see we have a little hall of fame in our office of different packs and things we bring back from around the world. And there is this, it's a vodka, I believe, from the Far East. And for all intents and purposes, it looks like a water bottle. I think it's got a sports cap. So all of the semiotic cues,
yeah,
for anyone who doesn't read the language, read Mandarin or whatever it may be, is, oh, fantastic refreshment.
Nick
and,
it.
Oh, see that off. And then whammy, as you pop the sports cap and guzzle it down and you're in a world of pain. So that's kind of design across borders and a failing of sort of acknowledgement of semiotic codes, yeah. I think.
Can I have another one?
Yeah, go on.
It just came to me the other day. It's a bowl dispenser for washing capsules or something like that. Mm. Great, you know, probably a great product. But I haven't got Trump hands, have I? They're all right.
No, reasonable size.
Extraordinary size.
Yes, average size.
You're all
hands.
In proportion.
Because you get a hand over the grip. They all who?
Yeah.
You put it between your legs and use two hands. Or, you know,
yeah.
I mean, for female hands are generally smaller. I can't think, because they're a great company.
Get a friend to help.
How do they do that?
I think for me it would be, it was sort of the best and the worst all in one go. And it was when Retail's moving to online. I couldn't wait not to set foot in a supermarket, and so delivery of shopping to my home was just is the bee's knees. It still is. I love it. But the frustration for me was that on one occasion I got an avocado sitting on the watercress in that sort of little see-through packet that they grow watercress in. So in one respect, it was the absolute perfect pack for the avocado because it was arriving, you know, on a mattress of loveliness. But of course, the watercress got annihilated in the process. And the frustration for me, and I think it, in a way for me, this is where this becomes bigger than just packaging design. It's these systems require designers across all of the different areas of design to work together, because the pack designer knows there's a snap-on lid for that plastic tub, which protects the watercress. But the digital guy who designed the website, which is where I placed the order, that went through to some packing place that then delivered the bags to my door, at some point someone neglected to think, actually, now that we're sending this someone to somebody in a plastic bag, the requirements of the pack are really different. And so, you know, where is the packaging designer in that discussion? Because the UX guy thinks he's just done the best digital job possible because I've placed my order with the brand. But of course, the stuff's arrived in the condition that it's arrived in.
But again, that's a that's potential as well, because you could have food packaging each other. So if it was done correctly, if it was a bag of crisps or something that had enough air in it that could support the avocado, then you've got this sort of symbiotic relationship between the... I'm getting excited now.
Here we go.
Maybe I will become excited.
I can tell you another one that doesn't work, which is 4 pints of milk and a quiche.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, same Nobody's bag, that there. Doesn't work. Yeah. 4 pints of quiche and a bottle of fairy liquid. Yeah, that doesn't work either.
4 pints of quiche, hey, that's
what did I
see that one there?
I've just had 4 pints of quiche. Yeah.
It's time to go home now.
Exactly. Right, so one last question, because I think it is time to go home. We sort of skate around the concepts of new materials every now and then. And I think this is quite an exciting area. Materials science is really exciting at the moment. Any examples? Could you each give me an example of a material that you feel is exciting to use in the future? Something that may be cropping up on the horizons, lighter, better, you know, less wasteful, something filmy, something exciting. Chris Griffin, any ideas?
Well, I mean, the problem with films currently is that we haven't got a system for reusing.
Oh, right, another one then.
What? Well, no, it would be films. It absolutely would be films. Yeah. But it would be films that have then got a system behind them.
So you build the system rather than the material.
Behind it and say, because the films, you know, I mean, all the issue is plastic is an absolutely fabulous material. Mm. We're just using it so badly and inefficiently.
Okay.
And if we're one of the exemplars in the UK, you know, around the world, they're using it worse. And we should be leading the way.
So that's the potential, is the system rather than the material.
The materials are fabulous, but when you've got five layers in a laminate, that's really a tricky thing to take apart.
Yeah.
But it's possible, particularly if you've got a volume. So if you get the whole country feeding into a recycling stream, then you stand a chance of making it work.
Yeah.
And saving food. I keep coming back to not having food waste.
Yeah.
And hence, a home delivery of a complete meal where you throw no food away. I guarantee we throw no food away these days.
Very good. Okay. Chris Orkett, materials or the system around it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's the kind of sexy examples of something like Uho, the water kind of globule membrane that's fascinating, and you know, who knows whether that's commercial and whether it will work, but it's incredibly interesting to see. But for me, I think there's just I'm quite excited about developments in the developing world where there's population boom and materials that can bypass some of our inconveniently unsustainable kind of processes that we've gone through. To see materials developments that can bypass that and in the developing world, you know, lead the way in new sustainable materials that for, whether it be laundry and, you know, populations that are just growing hugely, the middle classes around the world by 2050 are going to be absolutely huge. So things that can adapt, not thinking in our London-centric minds, but, you know, what are the opportunities for materials in Mumbai, or what are the opportunities for materials in developing markets where it's we're just going to see there's not necessarily infrastructure for recycling to necessarily be functional right now. So it's how can materials help that and bypass that, which is quite exciting, I think.
Okay, Deborah?
I'm creating my own systems. So an example would be we have a food caddy collection in Streatham, and I resent paying 5p for the bag that goes into that thing. And so I subscribe to a couple of magazines, which means I'm getting at least two of those packs that are biodegradable. And if you slice them open very carefully across the top, you can use the pack in your caddy bin.
Oh,
it's a good one, isn't it?
Yeah, I like that.
Because I don't want it on my compost. I've only got a small compost, and I don't want that big piece of biodegradable stuff sitting in there, because I don't think it will degrade fast enough on my compost. So, yeah, if the systems aren't there, create your own, reuse the stuff. And, yeah, I haven't bought a caddy bag for... 12 months. But I've got lots of magazines.
Excellent.
We could yak about this forever. And I find it absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much, Deborah Dorton, Chris Griffin, and Chris Orkett. And listen in to the next episode of Table Talk.
Thank you for listening to the Table Talk podcast. If you've enjoyed it, please share a review. If you like what you've heard, find out more on foodmatterslive.com or find us on Twitter and Facebook.